Testing.
Okay. You start by your name and your background. Tell me something about yourself.
My name is Jack Hardy. I'm 51 years of age. I was in the Winnipeg Grenadiers. One of the originals. I was joined in 39. Was down in Jamaica.
Tell me, why did you join the Grenadiers?
That's a good question. When I think back now, I was working at Eaton's at the time, and the war had just broke out, of course. And Roy Robinson and I, we were both working, as I say, at Eaton's at that time. We were walking down Portage in Maine, and they had these various banners across the street. Join this outfit or that outfit. And as we were going down Main Street, we were met by a chap, I think, what was his name again? I was a color sergeant. Poole. Yeah, Poole, Sergeant Poole. And he said, join the Winnipeg Grenadiers, and what was it he said? Oh, join the Winnipeg Grenadiers and do your winter training in the West Indies. So, of course, fun. Well, at the time, I guess we thought it was a little bit of malarkey, but we went back to work. Later on in the afternoon, on an impulse, I mentioned to my boss I was going to join up. So I went back. This was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And joined up.
Where did you live?
Went down to Main Street and was taken back to Minter Street Armories in some lorries. I remember I left my bicycle, in fact. I'd pedaled over to Main Street. What was that? I forget the number on Main Street now, the old Grenadier building. And left my bike there. And we're taken over to Minter Street Armories, as I say, and had a thorough medical. And sworn in.
Was Roy Robinson?
No, Roy. As I say, it was on the impulse. We'd been out and had our lunch around 12. And I went back about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and enlisted, and it seemed to me it was about a week after that Roy enlisted. When after he heard that I was having, he joined up. But as I say, I can remember the circumstances quite well, and I got my uniform, a part of it at least. I don't think I had a great coat. I gave me a tunic and trousers and putties and boots and... of course, I was late. I didn't get back to the old Grenadier building till I imagine it must have been about 6 or 6:30. And I asked one of the sergeants there if I could use the phone. Wanted to phone home. I phoned home and I told my mother I'd joined up. Of course, you know, get away with your bother. My mother's an old Lancashire woman. Get away with your bother. She said, oh. And I said, oh yeah, I have. So that was. The day that I enlisted.
September the 10th.
And I think it would be about a week later that Roy enlisted.
Did you have an interest in the Army people?
My father, of course, was an old Army man. And I had belonged to the Army Service Corps, not on a too regular basis. And I guess young and foolish, I thought the war was going to probably be over in a couple of months, you know, and I wanted to get in and see the country or get overseas.
That's okay. Yeah, but I didn't realize that when they told you you'd join up that you'd see Jamaica.
Is that the first time you've heard that story?
Yeah.
Yes.
That
well,
before you joined up, you know.
Yes, yes.
Yes,
yes. Well, this was, well, of course, I had no idea. It was just a gimmick, a come on, you know, and... I know he certainly looked quite elaborate with his red sash around this, and they call them color sergeants, of course. And here he was parading around on Portage Avenue trying to get the young fellows to join up. The first 3 months while we were at Minter Street Armories, it was more or less like a job. You reported, and I can't remember now if it was 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and you had parades and lectures and weapon training, or weapon lectures at least. We had very few weapons, of course, I think maybe had one or two of the old Vickers machine guns, and you been trained to a degree with them on stoppages and so forth. And the same as parading about on parade. We had route marches and around Minter Street armies. And as I say, it was, it was a big lark, I guess, I don't know how you could describe it. Everybody was having a lot of fun, and it certainly wasn't anything like the soldiering that was to come on later on. We, I think, if I remember rightly now, it was around about the 22nd of December that we moved into Fort Osmond Barracks, and it was an exceptional summer of that 39. It was a beautiful fall, otherwise I say not so much, beautiful fall, because it seems to me that around the 22nd of December, the date that we moved into Fort Osmond Barracks is about the first snowstorm that we had. Has the chaps have told you this the same?
No.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. And we were in Fort Osmond Barracks until the following May. I think it was May the 24th that we went down to Jamaica. And or was it we landed in Jamaica on May 24th? We were about a week or 10 days, I remember, on the boat. We were there until the following August, or the year the following August, we left Jamaica. And August, we landed back here in Winnipeg. It seemed to me about the 1st of September, or in around that time, we were given a month's leave. And when we came back, there were rumors were going about that we were going to be going on garrison duties again to India.
Tell me, when you were in Jamaica, did you contact any
dingy? Oh, dingy fever. I think nearly everybody had that when we were down there. And Dobie's itch and a few of these other minor skin problems.
Tell me, did you like the climate
yourself? Not. I didn't like it.
You couldn't take the heat?
No, my wife will tell you, even to this day, I don't like the heat. I prefer the cool, temperate weather.
And when you were guard duty the prison of war, did you get to know anything about
The Germans and the Italians?
Yeah. Were you interested at all, or you just did it as a job?
No, I think I was quite interested. Of course, they weren't really prisoners of war. They were internees. They were non-combatants, or the majority of them were non-combatants. And there was an awful lot of young fellows in there, and I remember that the Italians on one end there were ever singing, and they had their accordions out, and if I remember rightly now, there wasn't too much love lost between the Italians and the Germans that were in the camp. The Germans were, well, a different group than the Italians. The Italians seemed to be very excitable and temperamental and so forth, you know. But we had no problems with them whatsoever, none. There was little stories about them digging tunnels, but I never saw any, and I never heard of any escaping. Mm. No. They had a few, they
How
also
did
had...
How prisoners get there? What, were they in Jamaica at the time, or what?
Well, no, they were in various ports, I would say, in the West Indies. And furthermore, I think possibly that any German ships that were on the high seas were captured by the British Navy. And in fact, in June 41, no, not June 41, August, I'm sorry, August of 1940. We hadn't been in Jamaica too long. And we went down to Bonaire, which is in the Dutch West Indies, to pick up a number of internees. And I remember we went down there on the Jamaica Producer, and this ship, it was a banana boat. There was nothing in the hold, and about a day or 2 days out of Jamaica, we hit the tail end of a hurricane. And wow, was that rough. I was sick, and I remember a chap by the name of Bill Hardesty, who was killed later on in the war. He certainly was no sailor. I wasn't, but he was worse. We just strapped him underneath one of those life jackets there, or lifeboats there, I should say, and he just heaved.
He was continuously sick and poor devil. And we were all on deck. In fact, we had to take biscuits or polyasses on the deck. These were, of course, the decks were awash all the time. And waves were breaking right over top of the ship. And even, in fact, these internees, they were sicker than dogs. We had to periodically empty their buckets down there, and they had to get them up to empty their buckets. And I remember I was on guard duty on the rail there, heaving all the way over. Yeah. We were, I forget how long that trip would have been, maybe about 3 weeks. And we went back up to Newcastle. And Newcastle was a hill station up there, and it was beautiful up there. In fact, I think you remember one of the boys was mentioning to you, if you recall, there was 365 turns in this road from Kingston up to Newcastle. We can always remember that for the number of days in the year. And gosh, when you think back, our old 1500 weights, these little treks that we had, carrying a section of men, Lord, you'd be perched in the back of one of these things and looking over precipices down there. I wouldn't want to go up now. Well, I did then.
So when you came back to Winnipeg, you felt that it was the India.
Yes. Well, this is what the story was, and as I said, we had this this furlough. We came back. We didn't do any. It was just we knew that we were going somewhere, but just exactly where it was, we didn't know. As I say, that because if it seemed to me, now I've forgotten truthfully, that we were issued again with KD drill, you know, the summer drill. So you could pretty well figure that that you were going somewhere where it was going to be reasonably warm. And it was November the 16th that we landed in Hong Kong. So when would it have been? We were 21 days on the boat. I think it was 21 days we were on the boat, because I'm sure we were taking a zigzag path. We had a bit of a problem with some of the chaps on the boat. What their gripes were, I forgot, not just some minor things. But they pulled out when everybody was on board, and we moved out to, it seemed to me, around Victoria that following day. And we went from there to Hawaii. And while we were in Hawaii, I remember there was a group of the entertainers came down, and the girls in the hula skirts, and they were on the dock there and doing their hula dances, and the guys were on the board, hanging on the rail there, cheering, throwing dollar bills down and so forth. We didn't stay there long. I imagine we must have just fueled up. So that would have been possibly the latter part of October.
When did you realize you were going to Hong Kong?
I don't think that... it seemed to me now that we did the... we were told, I don't know if it was by the OC or who it was, that we were going into the Far East. But I don't know, truthfully, if they did mention Hong Kong. I've forgotten if they did. One little incident on the boat, I don't know if it was ever mentioned, but what we had, of course, sentries on board. It was the Awatea. It was a New Zealand ship that we went to Hong Kong with. And Roy Robinson, we were on the lookout for submarines. And I remember Roy Robinson sighted a submarine, or sighted an object. And he was commended the following day, and they said, fortunately, it was one of ours instead of one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was American submarine. And I don't know if Roy mentioned that to you. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that incident quite well. And we landed in... we went to the Philippines in Manila, which is just a short run from there to Hong Kong. And there again, it seemed to me that we might have spent a day in there, and then we moved on to Hong Kong. One little episode I might find amusing. There was a sergeant in the RAF. What was his name? Newman or Newland? And, well, anyway, when we got into this harbor, there was about three old planes, I imagine, something like slop with camels. They weren't that, though, but they were old aircraft. And they came out, and they buzzed the ship a couple of times, and I remember in the Hong Kong news, the rag from Hong Kong, in English, it had, RAF roars out to meet Canadian contingent. So, a funny thing, when we were going from Hong Kong to Japan, this chap was on this little river scow that they took us up to, from Hong Kong to Japan, and one of the chaps, you know, said, oh, you're in the RAF. He said, God, he says, and you're in the RAF. It came roaring out to meet our contingent. And I can always remember saying, well, you know, chaps, he said, I flew over you fellas there, and all you guys were up there, hooray, and we're waving at you. He says, and he said, I would like to wave back. He says, but I was busy holding one of the wings off. I can always remember that. He was quite a character. Where was I? I mentioned the word left. We landed to Hong Kong. We went to Sham Shui Po. And I was one that just after we were there, I think we were possibly there a week confined to barracks. And we were sent to the island. This was on the, when we landed there, we went to Kowloon, which is on the mainland. And I was there about a week, and I didn't get out, truthfully, too often in Hong Kong. I was maybe out about three times, and all the time before the war broke out. But anyway, we were there, and my company, my platoon, I forget now, maybe it was the whole company, I forgot now, we were sent to Hong Kong, and we were sent to the reservoir at Aberdeen. And they had pillboxes there, and you went like as a guard duty. And we had these cobblestone streets, and you were marching up and down like a side hill gouger. You know, these street hills, as you probably heard in Hong Kong. And we had to march from the dock to this area. I don't know how many miles it was, but I remember, Lord, with a full pack, I was pretty pooped, even with everybody else. And we had just marched back, and was going to take the ferry back to Kowloon, and we were told we were getting back. So they knew something was coming, so I didn't get back. They said, we've got to go back to your positions again. So we both wheeled and took off again, back to where we'd come.
Did you have any misgivings about
me? No, I don't think so. Probably too stupid.
Too young.
Well, no, it was an adventure, you know. And my platoon leader was a little chap by the name of Art Campbell. And there again, it was a funny little episode that happened with him. When the Japs came over, they dropped a few small, I don't know, maybe a couple hundred pound bombs on Hong Kong, and this was before we knew that we were officially at war with them. And but he couldn't get him. I mean, no sense having bargain. And Campbell called the whole platoon together, and as dramatic as can be, sit down. Dramatic as can be, he said, "We are now at war with the Japanese." Of course, everybody had the snickers. Like, why, you know, had they been doing playing with us, you know, dropping these little, well, these small bombs. But really, in the early stages of the war, and that, well, in fact, for the first week, we were continuously on guard. Pardon for me. Sit down. continuously on guard and expecting, I presume, the Japanese to be landing. And there was very little doing. We were just more or less, as I say, being prepared.
What was the old rumor factory doing?
Oh, Lord, they had Chiang Kai-shek coming out, and if we could hold them for a few weeks, that the Repulse and the Renown, and there was other, the British Navy was going to be coming to evacuate us away, and that, you know, it was, as long as we could hold out for a reasonable length of time, they would get us off. And,
sit down.
And, when I think back, you know, we must have been pretty gullible to believe all this, but of course we didn't really know the true circumstances, you know, I mean, it's how exactly what the British had there. Judging from what we saw ourselves, we certainly didn't have a great deal. All the armaments were pointed out to sea. I guess the British at that time never thought of anything coming from the mainland side, that they were out all the heavy armaments, the 8 and 10 inch guns out to sea, facing out to sea, and consequently they had very few batteries that were in a position to attack the Japanese from the mainland. I don't think it wouldn't have made any difference in the outcome anyway. But as it was, as I say, and we had no aircraft whatsoever, the three old tubs or four or how many they had, I don't know. Well, they were never in the skies. The Japanese came over as soon as the war broke out and knocked them out, and consequently the RAF was never airborne against them. Japanese would come over and be scouting our positions. They would be up at quite a height and observation planes. There was some AK-AK guns there. I think the Indians, if I remember rightly, had a Punjabs or wherever it was, had an anti-aircraft battery there, but they weren't anywhere near us. I imagine they would be closer to Victoria. And as I say, these planes came over just whenever they wished. One funny little episode that I was telling my wife and son today, and my wife will tell you, she's probably heard more now than she has in the last 25 years. I don't discuss the war at all. I think back that there was a lot of funny things that happened, and in 4 years, and there was, you know, and I don't delve on a lot of the other things. But anyway, getting back to this business, as I was saying about these Japanese craft coming over now, I could say it was Cecil Lowry and Bert Delbridge. Two of the chaps were in my platoon. They were inseparable. Now, you know, what is truth? I can remember the circumstances, but who the people were, I can't truthfully say now. But anyway, we were on this reservoir having our evening meal, and if you probably heard the boys talking about these mess tins. We had stew in one mess tin and tea in the other, and these darn things, they were absolutely scalding to put to your lips, these metal aluminum mess tins. And we just had this tea, and this plane came over, and he was quite a height. Well, of course, we're just spotting him up, and then we hear this bomb coming down. So there was a pillbox reasonably close to where we were, so I imagine he was maybe trying to drop a small bomb on this pillbox. But as it was, as it's coming down, these bombs make quite a screech. So we knew that they was dropping this thing, but just where it was going to hit, we didn't know. So it seemed to me that it was Bert Delbridge, but I could be corrected on Cecil Lowry. And anyway, as I say, we're all seated around, all go for cover. So we'll say that it was Bert Delbridge. I know it was Cecil Lowry anyway, who was the fellow that got it. As he was jumping to one side, he threw this scalding hot tea, and that's the only way to describe it. And it hit Cecil Lowry on the back, and he goes, "Ah!" Of course, just about the same time as this bomb goes off, you see, and he probably felt he's hit on the back.
Of course, we all had quite a little giggle over that. And of course, he wasn't really scalded, I don't think, but it must have been a terrible shock to him, just the time of this bomb going off and being hit in the back with some scalding hot tea. Sit down.
How long did you stay on that reservation?
Well, the Japanese landed around North Point. Well, they came to our company and they said, well, there's a small pocket of Japs landed. We've got to go up and clean them up. So, well, that was a bit of a fiasco. Anyway, we went up there and we didn't do a great deal of harm. We came back afterwards and my platoon leader was wounded.
Who was that?
Campbell.
Oh, Campbell.
Yeah. He had a slight wound. It wasn't too serious. He was away for a while. And we were mixed in with a few of the fellows from B Company and A Company. And they had really been hit hard. There's quite a number of those fellows who were in real bad shape. We evacuated that area. Jets were coming in pretty good then. And we went back to the bottom of Mount Cameron. And this time there was majority of our platoon. We'd had two or three fellows wounded. And we got in with a Major Giles. Chap that was in the Royal Marines, and he was a good officer. He was the chap that we were with for, oh, I guess possibly maybe 2-3 days. We had to move off from there. And we moved out during the night, where shelling was pretty good. And we went to a monastery.
This Marine officer, Major Giles, had he had any combat experience?
He was an older man, I can't remember now. He'd been a man, I would say, possibly maybe in the First World War.
Yes, he probably
yes,
had.
Yes, probably had, yes.
Did you set, yeah, would you set the fact that he had the experience?
Yes, well, he was he was a professional.
Yeah.
He was a man who had been in IFAS, if I presume, in the Royal Marines for a good number of years, and he was, as I say, an exceptionally good officer. Whatever happened to him, I don't know later on, because I was in the hospital, and when I after I got back to the camp. I can't remember now if he was there or not.
And where were you captured at Mount Cameron?
No, I was in the hospital that time.
Sit down.
I don't like to talk too much about the war, if you don't mind.
Well,
eh?
Okay,
no, yeah.
Okay, tell me what you want to talk about.
Yeah, good. There's unpleasant things, and maybe some people, why I say this, I mentioned to Roy that I feel they have access to grind against certain people, and I would just not say anything, you know.
What I was trying to do was pinpoint you about.
With the areas where I was? Well, you can say I was in Mount Cameron. One Shy Gap. And Bennett's Hill. Finished up at Bennett's Hill.
So you kept retreating from Mount Cameron?
Yes,
you retreated
yes.
To One Shy
Gap. Yes,
and
yes.
And then you were captured at
Bennett's Hill. Yes. Yes, I was in the hospital at that time, and there was quite a number of us in Bowen Road, yes, in Bowen Road Hospital.
Where were you injured?
In the leg.
No, but I mean, what? Which at One Track Gap? Or
no, no, it was at Bennett's Hill.
Bennett's Hill,
yeah.
And
yeah.
What were the scraps on the
roof? It was trench mortar.
And so the war was still in progress.
Oh yes, yeah, yeah. For another day after that, I was in Bowen Road Hospital. While I was in Bowen Road Hospital, the fellow in the next bed to me was a fellow by the name of Rose. And my wife will tell you now, I have a real love for opera. I can always, these are the things that I can always remember back better. I like to think back on. They used to play the recordings of, there was Lawrence Tibbett singing the Toreador song and the Largo Al Factotum, and I can remember I'd be laying in bed there and not being able to get up or anything, and I'd say, good God, what's that matter, that guy? What's, you know, I was probably more for the songs of the day. I wasn't too partial to opera at that time, and he, you know, he started to explain the stories of the operas and the songs and the arias that they were singing, and I really got to love opera. And after I came back home, my wife will tell you, I got quite a collection of operatic recordings, and like to get some of the ones that I really enjoyed at that time. You know, the Lawrence Tibbetts and Charles Chilton.
Was this fellow Canadian?
No, he was an Englishman. He was an older man. I knew him. I was in the hospital with him for the better part of a year. And
was he British?
He was an older man. He was in the Hong Kong Volunteers. He was in pretty bad shape. I remember he was so concerned about his family, and he told me that. And the majority of the other Britishers had had their wives and their families away. And I can always, you know, I thought it was odd that he didn't have his wife in Australia. The majority of them had left for Australia in the early part of 41, I think, or in the summer of 41, when the British knew that the Japanese were, you know, they were going to attack. Just, they didn't know exactly when, but they knew that they were going to attack. And they evacuated the majority of the civilians. But anyway, this fellow Rose, he used to always be talking about his family and his two daughters, if it seems to me now, or was it a daughter and son? I've forgotten. And this one day, he showed me a picture of his family. And I saw these two children, and there was this Chinese woman behind, and they call them Almas there. And I said, I was just going to say, you know, is that your Alma? And he said, you know, my wife is Chinese. And this is the first time that he'd ever mentioned that his wife was anything other than English, or at least a Caucasian, you know. And after that, of course, after he confided it to me about this, he was telling me a little bit about his wife. She had been brought up in a missionary in North Borneo, and she was teaching school or something in Hong Kong, and he met her there. And he was very, very concerned about her. She was in Stanley Prison, which is a civilian prison, and he got very, very few letters, I know, and he was so concerned about his family. I don't know if he ever knew. I never knew, you know, if he ever survived the war, because of course when I got out of hospital, I went to I know that we had it much better than the boys in North Point or Sham Shapeau. When I went to Sham Shapeau, the big diphtheria epidemic was over. There's quite a number of boys died with diphtheria, and mind you, it was quite a damn change when you're going from some clean sheets and everything in the hotel, in the hospital, going to old Sham Shapeau. And I know when I landed there, I weighed around about 150 pounds, and I went down possibly to about 120 before I went to Japan. And I was in Sham Shapeau, I guess, possibly close on a year, 8 months to a year. And
Then I went to Japan, and went to, we landed in Kobe in Osaka. We were billeted overnight in some old billets. In fact, we met a few Americans there. And, you know, you're trying to find out what was going on, where these fellas, and they'd come from the Philippines, and that's where I got those from one of the chaps in Kobe.
How long were you in Shanty Kobe before you were done drafted to Japan?
About a year. Close on a year.
Mm-hmm. And how was your leg? Did it feel completely?
Well, it was more of a blast than what I mean, nerve damage.
Oh, I see.
And it bothered me quite a bit for a while. I was, it was a lot worse when I went to Japan. With nerve damage, I guess. My wife will tell you. It's better now. When I first came home, I had to ride a bicycle, Betty, and it was about 3 inches smaller than the other. But anyway. When we landed in Kobe, as I say, we stayed overnight, and we were talking to a bunch of these Britishers or Americans, and we heard at that time from one of these chaps that they had met some Britishers from Hong Kong who'd had quite an experience. They had been on some ship and the Americans had torpedoed it. And I think, I remember writing that was the Lisbon Maru. I heard about it later on, and not knowing, well, I didn't know any of these Middlesex Regiment chaps, but, you know, inasmuch as they came from Hong Kong, we were quite concerned about them, and we were wondering if we'd be tied in with them. We went on this ship. It was an old river schooner. In fact, half of it was, the holes were filled with coal. And they just, you couldn't lay down. We were all jammed in there. You either had to stand up or else, you know, if you could sit down, you had to be squatted, your knees right up, and you were jammed in just like sardines. When we landed, we followed the coast of China. You could see mainland the majority of the time through the portholes. We landed in Taiwan. I don't know if the boys ever mentioned this to you. The first white men that we saw other than ourselves, I thought this looked like an old, how would you describe it, a type of schooner. And there was a swastika flag on it. And they would let you up to the latrines about twice a day. I remember going on the once, and we saw these German sailors, and we waved to them, and they waved back, and as much as we were both white, they waved back to us, but of course we never got in touch with them, other than just at the wave. But this, I presume later on, we must have been an armed raider that the Germans had in those waters.
It had
the swastika flag on it, yes.
But it had sails, did you say?
Well, it had the mast. It presumed it looked like a schooner, you know?
Yeah,
yes,
and
yeah.
Unusual, I guess they didn't have that much fuel in that over
there. Well, I would imagine they possibly, you know, it was, I say, it would be in a rouse for something or other, you know, that they would probably think the cover up, that's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to bring in this now, this is the first time I'd forgotten all about it, you know, until I remember landing in Taiwan. I forget now. Truthfully, we were there 2 or 3 days. There, I remember when they were coming into the harbor, they kept us and they would let nobody up on deck, and I don't know what they thought we were going to do, but after we left. Taiwan. No, it was in Taiwan. I'm sorry. The Japanese were very afraid of amoebic dysentery, and they checked everybody for amoebic dysentery, and they brought some Japanese nurses,
and they were in fact some of the first girls that we'd ever seen, and they were all in their little blue tunics and so forth, and they took samples of see for amoebic dysentery. That was quite an experience, and but none of us was taken off, so I presume none of us had amoebic dysentery that we were scared of. Did I mention, I don't know if the chaps mentioned to you, when we marched from Shamshapur Barracks to the docks, we would stuff ourselves with tea, fluids, just to give you that feeling of being bloated. Well, you can imagine, we had to walk, march on, I forgot, bursting for peas. I remember we were marching along, taking peas along at the Sarut march, because it was such a long way. But anyway,
how far would that be? 10 miles?
I don't think it would mean that. Maybe 4 miles. Yes, it was a long march. It seemed to me that it was took a better part of 2 hours. When we left, we went by train, and it took us 24 hours to go from Kobe to Oyama. And when you look at it on the map, it looks to be only a matter of 40 or 50 miles. It's very mountainous terrain. You had to go up, I imagine, looking at the maps later on, we must have gone close to Nagoya, and then back from Nagoya into the mountain ranges to this little town called Oyama. And when we landed there in Oyama, there was a little bit of a factory there. We landed with 200, we left with 200 men. There's 100 Canadians and 100 Britishers. There was a couple of fellas died when we were going up, or we were in the ship, and it was amazing. There wasn't a lot more died. It was terrible. And when we landed there in Oyama, we didn't have any interpreters. These Japs couldn't speak any English, and we couldn't speak any Jap. And they were going to train us just like rookies. Marching, I remember Migay was about to turn, and Ochuktori, that was the goose step they had. Oh Lord, real business. When we got there, we had beans and rice. The first time we'd ever had beans, for the last year, after being in Shamshapur, and we thought things were going to be pretty good. It wasn't too plentiful, but it was pretty good to what we had been accustomed to. Gave us they had what we used to call lugau in the morning, which was a bowl of like a thin porridge. They gave you a bun for your lunch. And for supper you had a little bowl of rice mixed with beans and sometimes a little bit of seaweed. That's when we first started there. It gradually got worse in the last year. But anyway, that first winter, we were working in the, first off, everybody was working in the, either in the factory or the, they had a type of a surface. They called it a copper mine. I don't know, we would like type
what
of a surface
mine.
Factory, well, we were all, we never, none of us worked inside. We were loading coal and pushing freight cars around. And this loading coal, we used to, obviously, back with some peculiar things, funny little things that happened. And, they had this, I imagine they would probably hold maybe about 3 yards of coal. And 2 or 3 fellas would push these things. And we were on top of these big slacks, heaps of coal, and throwing onto this coal, onto these little
type of boxcars or whatever you call them. And then we'd have to wheel it towards the old factory. Well, these Hanshaws or these Japanese guards around there, they wouldn't let you rest for a minute. You put your old shovel down and they were after you, and they didn't have swords, but they carried a little wooden type sword, and they'd give you a belt for that. And we had quite a little act going, you know, when the only way you get a bit of a break was you'd pretend to faint. And I remember, I think I used to do it as well as anybody. I'd be on the top and I'd just flake down and come tumbling down. That's loose coal. You never got hurt, you know. And of course, they'd come down and give you a peek at you, give you a boot on the ribs. And if you did, you know, if you didn't groan or anything, they'd leave you for a few minutes and or maybe a better part of an hour. And then you pretend you came to, you know. And then you should go, in fact, you'd go up to the top, and but of course, as I say, that
did they, do you think they got license?
I don't know if they ever did or not, because, you know, I can't imagine when I think back now that you would want anybody to give you a good belt in the ribs with a boot, but, you know, you felt that you had to do something, you know, to get a bit of a break, because they wouldn't let you break. Yeah, I guess they thought we were machines. And that winter,
really intermittent thing too on that.
Oh yes, well later on, at the beginning, I don't think. Well, I know I didn't know realize how bad things were. You know, I mean, we you'd go to work with some fellas and bring them back dead at night. Well, you know, I mean, it's hard to realize, you know, that fellas would get up and walk and go to work and die out there, you know. But it happened.
Tell me, what pulling work did you have there?
I had my old tunic. I had some equipment there, an old jacket the Japanese had given us. Type of running shoes, they call them jikitabis. No socks. We had quite a number of our fellows lose toes and that with frostbite. I saw more snow in OEM than I've ever seen in Canada in all my life. We had dark tunnels from one hut to another. Mm-hmm. And it was that first winter, it was grim, and we were, I think we lost 40 men out of the 200 that first winter. And things really looked bad.
Tell me, the commandant and the Japanese people there in charge of the camp, did they want to lose your men, or did they need you for the labor?
No, I think that to give them full justice, the Japanese, by the Americans and the British, had them so tightly blockaded. They didn't have enough food for themselves. Mm-hmm. And if the Japanese are as bad as some of the people who depicted them, we wouldn't be here today. They wouldn't. By their standards, I think that they treated us reasonably well. There was an oil trap in our camp, a fellow named Morita. There was a number of things that happened in our camp, but I think back now that I don't know if we would have been any different, you know, like old Morita. As I say, he lost three of his boys in New Guinea, I think it was, and they're very stoical type people. I was working in the gardens. I was in charge of a benjo party, emptying the latrines. And Marita,
We had a bit of a project on it. We tried to grow as much of our own vegetables as we could. They had put seawalls out, and then on the surface mines, everything that we were scraping out, we were hauling in these flat cars and dumping out and reclaiming the land. It'd been processed. It would just look like a black gumbo mess. You wouldn't have thought a decent weed would have grown in it. But the Japanese, we built a bit of a garden in it. We just with straw and fertilizer, we grew daikons, which is a type of winter radishes. We grew yams, and I had a little tomato. A plant that I managed to scrounge from the Japs, well, a couple of seeds or something that I started, and I had some green tomatoes off it. This was in the last year of the war. And Womarita, as I say, that I used to have to go and get him, and he would take our group out in the gardens, and we would work there the day, come in for a bit of soup or bun or whatever it was that we had at our lunch. And we were not beyond pinching it when we could. I remember this one day I had a few little strings of these sweet potatoes, and they were just like little roots. And I'd stuck them in my raincoat. And periodically the Japanese would have these inspections. And you had your number, and this was a bit of a jacket that I had, type of a raincoat. My number was Hyakukujoroku, which is 196. And I got called to go to the Jimisha, which is the office. And this time we had a interpreter, and he said that I had been stealing food. So I said, oh, I haven't. Because I knew if they said I had, I was in for it. So I said that Marita had given them to me. They called on Marita. I can always remember him saying, Dandy, and that's what. You know, and he mumbled something, but he must have told them that he'd given to me. And I got away with it. But it was a funny thing. We would be working out. And for instance, we would grow four crops in a year. We'd have daikons. Then we had Irish potatoes. And we had sweet potatoes and daikons again. So we had four crops. Running, we would start in about March, running through to about November.
And did you people benefit from it, or is that?
Yes, it was to our for our camp, but there wasn't a great deal of it, as I say. There was that. It probably helped. We had by this time, you see, the Americans were in our camp. They brought more and more in. They had the Japanese. Had brought in a number from Yokohama. The Americans had Kobe and Osaka all blockaded, and they were trying to use this little port that we were called, where we had in Yazoo. And they were bringing in a few ships from Korea in there, and they brought these Americans, the majority of the East Coast were in fantastic shape compared to us. I think at this time I weighed around about 96 pounds. And they were working on these ships. So as I say that, it was a help, but not a great deal. We used the tops of the sweet potatoes, just like the leaves. We made a bit of a soup with that. And not too much of the daikons. I managed to pinch one every now and then, which was probably
a lot better than a lot of the other fellas. Remember,
did you get beriberi?
Oh yes, I think we all had that beriberi in Palagna. I had when I was in Japan. I was mentioning that first winter, I took very sick, and I was in the hospital and lost my sense of equilibrium. I remember they had not this time, they had an Australian doctor there, Dr. Stinney. And he injected, I think it was probably some vitamin compound right into the spine. I had six of those spinals. And that did bother me because there was a number of the fellows were getting infection from needles in their arms and that, you know, and had to have them lanced and so forth. And that was one heck of an experience, getting that damn needle stuck into your spine. I had six of them. Probably helped, you know. And I had, I don't know if anybody, they had some Britishers and one Canadian in there that we could have done well without. I guess you've heard about them. Tugby and Harvey and Dean.
Well, all I've heard of is that two wouldn't set the court much.
Well, I guess all I'll say is that probably could have done a lot better without them. But anyway, Harvey, I can remember. Harvey was an opportunist, and he approached the Japanese early on, like I mentioned, even when we had no interpreters, and maybe because he could speak a few words of Japanese, he got in with the Japs and said that he would be type of disciplinarian in the camp. I was in the hospital, as I mentioned, that first winter, and they gave us a Red Cross parcel. It was the only one we ever had in all the years I was I never had one in Hong Kong. That's the only one I ever had in Japan. And in it we had, it seemed to me it was about 8 pounds of foodstuffs. We had a pound tin of dried milk. There was 3 of those little quarter pound tins of butter. There was a can of Spam, a can of one or two cans of Spam. There was a bar of chocolate. And
cigarettes?
No.
I guess it wasn't all very fun.
No. But anyway, I ate the whole thing in one day. The whole can. I remember this Harvey called me in and called me before him and he dressed me down and he said, if you want to cripple that, knock the shit out of you. I can't remember that. And I said, yeah. And I said, look, you know, just wish you'd have said that to me about 3 years before. I said, and we'd have seen who had, you know, the old what's name knocked out of him, you know. But that was the only deal that I ever had with Harvey myself.
Was Harvey better said than better
told? Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. There was Mark Tugby. I feel sorry for Mark Tugby. Mark Tugby was the one that was, he was in my company. And I think we were reasonably friendly. I remember, I'm not saying that, could say this was attributed to Harvey, but Harvey had beat one of the fellows up. And the following morning, we found him dead in his blankets. And remember Mark Tugby said that he was going to get Harvey after the war. Tugby was sick the same time as I was. And this old Harvey, as I say, was an opportunist, and Tugby was the senior NCO at the time, Canadian NCO. He brought him into the fold. They brought a Japanese, they brought an American doctor in the last 6 months of the war, who was another one we could have done well without. He was another that Harvey used in his defense later on. Dean and Rogers were the two other Englishmen who were cohorts of Harvey. I don't think that, I think they again, were possibly influenced. You know, self-preservationism.
That's right.
Is quite a motivation. And I don't, you know, some of the people who are maybe Harveys and the Tugbys and the Deans and the Rogers, greatest critics, would have maybe done similar things under them if they'd had the opportunity. But because they didn't, you know, they could afford to, well, to be very, very bitter. And I don't like to think that I'm bitter now. I'm not bitter against the Japanese. I'm not bitter against anyone.
But this fellow who died in the was beaten by Harvey, and he died then. And that was by his beating, most likely. Of course, that's a definite statement. Yeah, no,
well,
say that.
I don't like to think that.
Of course, his health would be another thing.
Well, this is it. We there was many fellows died in the camp.
How did you bury your men?
They were all cremated. Mm-hmm. We took them out. In fact, I've often wondered. We had in the hospital. We had all these little urns of the so-called ashes for these chaps. I never ever knew what ever happened to camp. Any of the fellows that were, because we were all evacuated out of there. The Japanese take quite a storage, you know, in the ashes.
Mm-hmm.
Mob. Anyone that's passed on and worshiping their ancestors and so forth. We had all these chaps' ashes in urns. I don't know what ever happened to them. If they were the ones that were buried in Yokohama or Osaka or wherever the Japanese cemetery is in Japan. We didn't have any, there was no, as I say, that they were all cremated and we had these urns in the camp.
Who did the cremating?
Japanese. We just took the bodies out. You know, I guess you've heard all these gory stories.
Yeah, I have.
Is that wow? I don't like to, well, you know, I thought maybe, but you possibly have heard a number of stories. Other than people who were to be there, it's hard for, I think, if someone were to tell me, you know, how things could be, you know, so it's just so many words. I don't think, you know, that you could really visualize how things actually were. Even today, you know, I don't, this is one reason, as I said, you can see, I don't believe in, I can truthfully say, I have no animosity against the Japanese. And or any of our fellas, or when I say our fellas, I mean fellas in our camp, Harvey, or the Tugbys, or anything, because I think I gained something from it. Well, Johnny Popel was a very close friend of mine. I think you've had your tape with Johnny. I know he went up to Kobe. He was in the hospital there for some time. He was a very close pal. I mentioned that I used to scrounge a few little things from the gardens, and in the latter stage of the war, Johnny was in pretty bad shape, and we used to try and get a few little things to him.
Sid Varco was another one of my pals.
Did you sort of, a bunch of you sort of stick together, you sort of fall off into little groups and those who had certain interests, certain things, sort of stuff together?
I think that, well, for one thing, all the Canadians were together and all the Britishers were together in the huts. Mm-hmm. In the latter step, no, I'm sorry, they integrated us all at the very last few months when they brought some other Americans in. They were, well, it was Britishers and Canadians. One funny little episode, I don't know if I ever mentioned it, was Freddie Adams, Sergeant Major Adams. He never learned to speak Japanese, and even to this day I can still bongo his number in Japanese, and so forth, you know. And we would line up, and of course Freddie always liked to be up in about the first 10, so at least he could remember Ichi-ni-san-shi-go-roku-si-chi-hechi-ku-ju or something like that, you see. But it got beyond that, and there would be maybe a 22 or 23 in a hut. He, if it got Niju-ichi or some darn thing like that, they would say, you know, he'd count out, oh, I'm 21, how is that? And well, you'd have to say Niju-ichi, well, okay. But every now and then the Japs would say, all right, bongo from the other end. And if he was somewhere in the middle and his number was 12 from one side and maybe 14 from the other, or whatever the case may be, or 10 even, old Freddie was a problem.
Mm-hmm. You guys would try to help
him. We try to help him, yes, in that sense. I think that I was a bit of a linguist, that I learned to speak a little bit more Japanese maybe than some of the other chaps. And because with old Marie, who I did mention earlier on, when we would be out at, he would show me a potato and his tobacco, and I'd say, potato, and eat some potato, and go off, and he'd be muttering it to himself, and he'd come back later on, potato or potato or whatever, you know, he'd make some phony pronunciation, rather, and I'd say no, and I'd tell him again. And so he, was, I say, I wouldn't classify as one of the enemy. He was as a good head, old Marita. There was a real good companionship between the majority of the fellas. Mind you, this self-preservation bit was at most in more people's minds. And I remember I used to say to myself, there's one son of a gun walking out of here, it's going to be me, you know. And I guess probably everybody else felt the same way.
What did you put for life?
I think one thing that there was the will to live, and that self-preservation bit. And I remember some of the chaps that did pass on were worried about their families or something like that. And of course, I didn't have a lot to worry about in those days. Just about myself, really. And I think that was the fact that I thought to myself, I'm gonna make it out of here. And I think possibly maybe this is, everybody felt that way to a degree, but.
Did you get any news, or how did you keep yourself informed on the war and so forth?
No. This is going back again. When I was in hospital, we had a radio for the, some of the orderlies had a radio hidden, and they would put it on maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks, because, you know, the Japanese would soon find out if there was one to be on. I guess they had some type of a surveillance or other that they could check if there was any radios in the building. And we used to get a little bit of a news, you know, by the grapevine, that, and at that time, and that would be in, of course, in 1942, things certainly weren't going good for us. And but in camp, in Champ Chapeau, when I was there, it seemed to me that there was a radio, and little bits of news would leak out, but
you know, in the first 2 years of the war, well, for us, that into 42 and 43, there was no good news we heard. Nothing that would make us think that we were going to get out there in any reasonable length of time. It was, mind you, I think that there was periodically some ridiculous rumor going around that they were going to be trading, swapping POWs, but when we got to Japan, majority of these things, it was a case then that we knew that war was being brought home very close to the Japanese because they were consistently bombing the areas. In fact, just 2 weeks before the end of the war, where we were, I mentioned earlier on that we were in this little town called Miyazu, and in Japanese mythology, they had said that there was a stairway to heaven, and these gods used to come down and play on these little islands, and but they had to be back at a certain curfew, and sometime, so the story went, that these little gods who went down there didn't make it in time, so they threw the staircase down, and as it was, just which we saw after the war, when we used to be, in fact, we were on the scrounge, the Americans had been dropping supplies to us, peaches and so forth, and we were going around the countryside and seeing if we could get a few fresh eggs and things like that. They were very, very scarce, but they were, they could be had if you knew exactly where to go. But anyway, getting back from that, in this little Miyazu, the latter stages of the war, the Japanese were using this as a port. They were bringing in supplies, and this one day, this was within about 3 or 4 weeks of the end of the war, this B-29, Japanese used to call them B-Nijuku, came over, and all you could see was the vapor trails. You couldn't see the plane, but you could see these four vapor trails. Came over, and at this time, I mentioned that they had the Americans in there and to unload these ships. They had these stevedores. We had a few of our fellows doing little menial jobs. And this work party went out, and we lost a few of the fellows. They were loading a salt ship I'm getting away from the story again. All right, this B-29 came over. By the time our work party was going out, it would be around about 6 o'clock in the morning. About 7:30, just waves and waves of Grumman Hellcats and British and American aircraft from aircraft carriers start hitting all these ships. There was about, we had a real view of this thing. We were right on the bay. I mentioned earlier on, if you recall, they had these seawalls out, and we were reclaiming land behind our camp, and you could see right out into the bay, a beautiful spot. And we saw these ships in the harbor. This B-29 came over, and shortly afterwards, they started bombing, and they bombed all through to about 4 o'clock in that afternoon, wave after wave after wave. They didn't drop anything on our camp at all, but they did. They sank all these ships, or they were burning them. And a number of the fellows were on board one of these salt ships. I think a party of about 12 fellows. And not all of them were killed. I think there was about 3 or 4 killed. The Japanese hand shot the little fellow that was in charge of them, lost both his legs, and that would have been, as I say, just a few weeks before the end of the war. And just before we left, he was one of the better civilian hand shots, or civilian foremen. His two sons brought him on a wheel, a stretcher into the camp, and I know our fellows gave him a number of, told you the Americans had been dropping supplies to us, and we gave him canned peaches and things like that the Americans had given us. He was one of the, there again, there was good and bad in the Japanese, and there were some good ones too, you know. There was fellows that, under the circumstances, as I said, you couldn't really look upon them as true enemies, I don't think.
I think that when I look back now, that well, I wouldn't want to have the experience again. I think I gained something from it. That possibly, I think, I like to think that I read people pretty good. And as the old saying goes, that that veneer is very, very thin, and when under circumstances, under stress, you know, that little false face that we can all put on at times can come off pretty quickly under these conditions. And I think that while I don't have the most patience, after I think it over, I, as I say, I think I read situations pretty well.
Tell me about your adjustment after the war.
After the war, when we came back home, I started back in the tea company where I had been working before as a kid. And I was married shortly after. And my wife had quite a bit to put up with me for 2 or 3 years. I was quite a drinker, but I think not that it was I wasn't the drink so much as it was the companionship. There was something that you wanted, that those 4 years you had to catch up. And well, you knew there was something lacking. Even I know Betty, I'm sure, felt that what was the problem? Why didn't I want to come home and spend the evenings with her? And and our son was just a baby at that time, and it wasn't that I wasn't unhappy or anything, but it was just something lacking. And it took me some time.
Were you in the hospital after you came back?
Yes, I had quite a dose of hookworm, and they were treating me for that. And I was in for, 8 months maybe? They had quite a time clearing these things, and they're very, very infectious, as you know. We're quite concerned about that, but the family managed to, so I managed to clear them up. I was in the hospital before we were married, Betty, for a few months, and then I was in again afterwards, that whole winter, Ray. What would that have been, 1947? 46, 47? Yeah, it would be 46, the winter of 1946. I was in the hospital all that year. There was a lot of our fellas in at that time, Percy Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you, Deer Lodge Hospital? Deer Lodge Hospital, yeah, there was in. In fact, I think that Percy and I are. It was just a hotel to us. I used to go out and get a crock or a case of beer and finish to get out in the afternoon, you know, and come back with all of the time, Betty, about when he was inebriated. You know, I remember all of that. I had a case of beer, and we had it under Percy's bed, and we had the sheets and blankets over on either end, and we'd be nipping at this pretty good. And old Percy was in a half drunken stupor. I remember he was grunting and snorting, and one of the young nurses came about, and I don't know if she thought he was having some type of an attack or rather, and she went running from his bed, and I remember I was snickering to myself because old Percy was grunting, I say, twitching, and the old nurse came on, the head nurse, and she says, "This man is inebriated." And lo and behold, they found this case of beer under the bed, and I was automatically discharged the following morning. And I'd been wanting to get out, and I was called in. I remember before all that, this was that first winter, Betty, before we were married. And I had been trying to get out, and they wouldn't let me out. And I was called up before old Anderson, who was the administrator of the hospital, and he said to me, "What did I think this was?" I said, "This was a hospital and not a glorified hotel." And I said, "Well, fine, give me my discharge." And he gave it to me, and well, promptly about a week afterwards, I was called back in again and had to go in again. But they watched us a little more closer then, and they couldn't get the old booze to old Percy, who certainly missed it because he wasn't in a position to get any.
Mm-hmm. Are you on pension?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was 30% pension right from the time I came back home. And,
you know, when you lost the pension.
Oh, yeah, that was water under the bridge now.
And do you see your, you belong to Hong Kong Association?
Yes.
And you go to there too, so.
Well, I go to the major. I like to see the fellas, but Betty is a non-drinker and
party
pooper.
No, it's not that either. I often feel that a lot of those things are more for stags and women.
Mm-hmm. She, I guess, remembers back in the days of 46 and 47 when I would go to these things and I would be really get looped.
Did you have a hard time adjusting to your job?
For a while, yes. I think, as I say, as well, possibly maybe for about 3 or 4 years, it took me a little time to really adjust to the Well, you know, getting back into the old groove again and even living a reasonable type of life, you know, where before, as I say, that I thought I was going to miss so much and have to keep making up. But,
What type of work do you do now?
Now I'm a returns assessor, which, of course, probably doesn't mean anything to you, but I'm in charge of all the returns coming back at the service building.
That's fine. I can't think of anything else. How's your health?
Pretty good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tragic old age.